And welcome to The Beat. I am Ari Melbourne. Tonight, we have new reporting on that New York Times bombshell about Donald Trump's top accountant facing charges within the next 2 months. His former colleague, Michael Cohen, is here on The Beat live tonight with exclusive reaction. Our top story right now is President Biden facing down Vladimir Putin today in Geneva, pressing him over domestic crackdowns and international attacks.
I told President Putin my agenda is not against Russia or anyone else. It's for the American people. It's not about just going after Russia when they violate human rights. It's about who we are. That's why we're going to raise our concerns about cases like Alexei Navalny. I made it clear that we will not tolerate attempts to violate our democratic sovereignty or destabilize our democratic elections, and we would respond. I think there's a genuine prospect to significantly improve the relations between our two countries.
Do you believe you can trust him?
This is not about trust. This is about self-interest.
U.S. administrations in both parties historically have tried different postures towards Putin's Russia, including the controversial reset during the early Obama-Biden administration. But nothing compares to the past 4 years of Donald Trump as president backing up Putin's propaganda while welcoming his election help in the U.S. And just about everyone agrees today is quite different already under Biden. That includes Putin himself.
President Biden is an experienced statesman, and in this, he is very different from President Trump.
Let's begin tonight with former RNC Chairman Michael Steele and Julia Yaffe, a journalist who's covered Russia for many years, is now Washington correspondent for the media company Puck. Julia, what do you think we should take as Americans watching all this in their first face-off?
Well, I think what the Biden administration wants us to take away from this is exactly the opposite of what the media is doing. I think the Biden administration wants this to be a kind of non-newsworthy, more regular event where the American side talks to the Russian side and there isn't all this hoopla and media circus and pomp and circumstance around it. That is just like any meeting with any other country, that it's more predictable and focused on tangible things rather than press opportunities. I think the Russians are pleased to be recognized as kind of equals, as partners, and to be talked to at all, frankly.
Michael?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, Putin was just glad to be in the room. This is not a question of, having the same kind of relationship where he would walk onto that stage as much more of a dominant player over Trump, as we've seen, when they've met before. Biden brought a whole different caliber of that, to that relationship, acknowledged by Putin himself when he says, he's a skilled diplomatic kind of guy, and this is good for the country. It's good for our allies, and it's good for the relationship between our two nations. You cannot repeat enough and make clear enough that the outside of nuclear weapons, there is not much else there. All right. You're talking about an economy that is what, $1-2 trillion versus $21 trillion here in the U.S. So there are a whole lot of differences that Putin understands that exist between our two nations. The linchpin in that is nuclear weapons and the role that Russia plays in places like the Middle East and the impact that they can have certainly and have had and are having currently in Eastern Europe. So that sort of keeps them in the conversation. And so what Biden did today, and I think a lot of people agree, was a reset over what we've had over the last 4 or 5 years. And now there's going to be some adjustment on the part of the Russians in dealing with the United States.
And Michael, the president obviously knew there was going to be a lot of attention on this, even to the point Julia makes, perhaps more than they wanted, given the mood they're setting. He did have a little bit of a flashpoint here with a reporter. Take a look.
Why are you so confident he'll change his behavior, Mr. President?
Yeah, I'm not confident in changing behavior. What do you do all the time? When did I say I was confident?
I said,
let's get it straight. I said, what will change their behavior? is that the rest of the world reacts to them and it diminishes their standing in the world. I'm not confident of anything. I'm just stating the fact.
Michael, first of all, Journalism 101, you always throw out the extra question. People say, why bother? And then every so often, you get the subject marching back. He was vehement there, and for good reason, in the sense that he wants a very clear guidepost of what they are and aren't expecting. Walk us through that moment.
Yeah, Politics 101, keep walking. Don't stop. Just when you end it, keep going. Let them throw their questions. You don't hear. I hear nothing. We're walking. We're walking. That's what he should do. But having come back to answer the question, he got short. And he what he heard her say was a misinterpretation of what he had been saying. And so he wanted to clarify that. And so I'm not as exercised about that, because compared to what we've seen presidents, the last president do in, with the press and reporters, okay. And Biden came out immediately and apologized. He said, yeah, I was short. I shouldn't have been. But it does speak to, I think, the kind of pressure that sort of exists around this relationship as it's being reshaped by the Biden administration between the U.S. And Russia. And so he wants everyone to understand, especially Russia. He doesn't want this, you know, I'm confident that Putin is going to change his behavior. He doesn't want that narrative out there, because he recognizes who he's dealing with. And he recognizes that that's not going to be the kind of position that's going to achieve the goals for the United States, particularly if Putin takes that and goes, oh, so that's what you're trying to do? And it just changes the whole dynamic. So he wanted to be clear.
Yeah. And Julia, on all the hacking and sort of digital cyber attacks here, some of which seem to be linked back to the Putin government. Obviously, the Mueller report documented that in that context. But recently there have been these others that might be non-state actors, might be just criminals over there. It seems to be an escalating issue where the U.S. has to play catch up. I think any administration taking it seriously, they've dealt with these sort of ransomware attacks. They've dealt with the having companies pay people off and then trying to track back down what they paid in Bitcoin. Anything going on beyond the stage or behind the scenes to get more control over this in Russia? Or is it something that U.S. officials basically feel at a certain level they just have to live with?
Well, I think, you know, from the Russian perspective, it's very important for them to build in this appearance of plausible deniability. Well, they're not employed by the government. They don't work for the GRU. They're just random guys, you know, as Putin called them, artists who wake up in the morning and decide to paint, and he has no control over them. And this has been the case for many, many years, including, you know, in the some of the hacks around 2016. From the American perspective, it's like, yeah, we know you're in an authoritarian police state. You're telling us you don't know where these guys live. You can't track them down. You can't twist their arm. You can't threaten to arrest them or to arrest them and extradite them. That's frankly BS. So I think behind the scenes, what we're seeing is that the Americans are ramping up potential, you know, what Biden said earlier this spring, that there are going to be measures that are seen and unseen. And today he said, look, there are people sitting in Florida, and I'm guessing in Maryland and Virginia, who could go after your oil pipelines, and you probably wouldn't like that very much, because, you know, the Russian economy is kind of a one-trick pony.
Hmm. Michael, just briefly, they did get into politics because you have a press avail with the president talking McConnell. Take a look.
Mitch McConnell said that if Republicans were to take back the Senate in 2022, he did not see a way that you could get a Supreme Court justice confirmed.
Mitch has been nothing but no for a long time. And I'm sure he means exactly what he says.
Not the biggest counterpunch. What did you think of that?
No, he's right on both points. And, you know, I wouldn't expect Joe Biden to land a counterpoint. A counterpunch there, because he knows he needs Mitch McConnell on infrastructure and a host of other things. But it should be a wake up for Democrats to begin to do the counterpunch downstream. In other words, the president is the president. The Democratic Party is the politics. And they've got to create the space for the president to be able to use that as a weapon against his adversary in the Senate when that adversary is using politics to block his agenda. He's not blocking yeah. Biden on policy. He's blocking him on politics. And so right now, yeah. the president of the United States needs a political hammer. And only the Democratic Party can provide that. Not Democratic legislators in the Senate or the House, but the party, the political operators that do that kind of work. And that's why right now the Republicans have the advantage. And Biden, you could tell in that moment, he was sitting there going, damn, I know. Okay, yeah, this is where I am. And you know, Mitch means what he says. And there's not much I can do about it until I get a political hammer.
Right. He said what he said. Michael and Julia, thanks to both of you. We've got a lot coming up in the program. New fallout on these revelations about the Trump org probe, when we might see charges. We have the journalist who broke that big story coming up. Also, my live interview with Michael Cohen on what he thinks it might take for this money man to flip on Trump himself.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com. Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
The New York DA's probe into the Trump Organization has just hit a new high. Now, on the one hand, it's been going for years. The DA won the Supreme Court battle for Trump's taxes, then impaneled a grand jury, then summoned a key financial witness before that grand jury. But now the new high is moving towards a potentially key indictment as soon as this summer, according to that major report in the New York Times that picks up on the big name in the case.
Alan Weisselberg. He's the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization.
Alan Weisselberg.
Alan Weisselberg.
Alan Weisselberg was everything to that organization.
But always Alan Weisselberg on the check.
I think that all roads lead to Alan Weisselberg.
The gatekeeper for every penny that came in and went out.
Whatever Trump did and spent, whatever he told the government or didn't about all of that, Weisselberg's involved. He's the centerpiece of Trump's financial operation. While the DA wants to know what he knows about Trump, this new reporting shows the heat on what Weisselberg himself has been doing, whether he illegally hid valuable benefits or compensation, ranging from tuition payments to evidence on the full story behind his Mercedes-Benz and the grand jury's hearing evidence on him. And that's what's so concerning for Donald Trump here. We already had clues that Weisselberg was key. You see it in the reports, in the discussion. The New York Times, though, is now putting the talk of indictments in a headline, because their sources say the grand jury is already getting the case against Weisselberg. And you know the old saying about grand juries, that they can indict a ham sandwich. Well, if they're hearing the case against Weisselberg, the next step is to decide whether or not to charge him. The final goal of the DA is clear: put enough heat on Weisselberg with a credible fear or outcome that he or even his family would go to prison. And then that is supposed to make him flip on Trump. And the same story notes what we've also been discussing and reporting, the signs that Weisselberg has, up to this point, quote, rebuffed cooperation requests. We also know this particular DA, Cy Vance, his term ends in December. He got the taxes. It appears he has a lot of evidence. He has several witnesses. He has a grand jury impaneled. And very soon, he'll have to take that all together, and it will be time to either move or move on. Now, I mentioned this report that has so many people in legal and Trump circles paying attention. Well, we are thrilled to be joined by one of the New York Times journalists who broke this very story with his team, Jonah Bromwich. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Ari.
You don't put indictments in a New York Times headline based on nothing. Obviously, you're not here to discuss confidential sources and the like, but what gave you in your reporting process the confidence to say not that this individual is under investigation or that it could be bad, but rather, as you put it, he could face charges as soon as this summer?
Well, it's exactly what you said, Ari. Grand jury has been hearing evidence about Mr. Weisselberg. We know that the prosecutors in Mr. Vance's office have really obtained a full picture of his financial situation. They've gotten his personal tax returns. What it looks like is that they're finding out kind of everything they can find out about Mr. Weisselberg. And so the stage that they've reached, the evidence that they're hearing in the grand jury, just gives us that confidence to be able to report that.
One thing that happens with especially a paper that's as widely read and studied as the New York Times is people debate what things mean online in the comments, et cetera. Now we get to just ask you. So when I read this line in the lead, setting up, quote, the possibility he could face charges this summer, does that mean the charges are more likely than not?
I always think questions like that are interesting. We report what we know. And so what you read in the lead is what is true. You know, it appears the office appears to have entered the final stages of the investigation. He could face charges as soon as the summer. Now, at this point, there are times at which we know more than we've reported yet. And then we report it. This is what we reported. And this is what we know.
Do you think the DA's office likes seeing a story like this out because it puts even more heat on Weisselberg?
There is no question that the DA's office is trying to put pressure on Mr. Weisselberg, but they can kind of put that pressure on him themselves. They have the tools to do that. They don't need our help to do that. And of course, that is what they're doing. They are trying to put pressure on him right now.
In reporting on this grand jury, which is very secretive, are you finding it similar to others, even tougher given its high profile, or perhaps you're getting more clues because there are so many people and lawyers and witnesses around?
That's a good question, and it's not one I really have the experience to speak to. I couldn't compare it. Each investigation is its own creature, is its own beast. This one is what it is, and so it's hard to compare it. I hate to kind of dance out of that question, but it's not an easy comparison to make.
You don't have a law degree, right, Jonah?
I don't have a law degree. You do, right?
I happen to, but I was going to say you're dancing and parsing, which is part of the duties of your job, is it's at a lawyerly or Talmudic level. So take that for what it's worth. Let me play a little bit of one of the witnesses that we've caught up with here, Jennifer Weisselberg, who, as we've reported and your story mentions, has other disagreements with Alan Weisselberg. Folks can factor that into the analysis, but she's making claims that presumably she might also share in these high-stakes interviews with the DA's office about the lengths he went to hide basic things like tax returns, even from, you know, real estate arrangements. Take a listen.
Alan himself admitted to me that his taxes and pay stubs, he said, I'll never show those. Oh, no, he's supposed to be the guarantor on my apartment, my lease, after I was getting divorced. And he said, oh, no, I can't show my taxes. I can't show my pay stubs. And I thought, why not? Basically, he was saying they're illegal and I'm not releasing them. It was during the Cohen SDNY investigation. Pretty telling.
What does your reporting show about the criminal legal exposure Mr. Weisselberg could face in this office if they do determine evidence that he did not accurately account for or pay taxes on large benefits or compensation from Trump org?
That is something that we know that the prosecutors are looking at. They're looking at something called fringe benefits, which are a specific type of benefit. It could be car rentals. It could be apartment. It could be tuition for a grandchild. And that's something we know in part that the prosecutors are very focused on. There are situations in which Mr. Weisselberg could be in a lot of trouble depending on what he did in taxes on those kinds of benefits. But in terms of how exposed he is, I think we'll have to wait and see more and see what the case, if an indictment is actually brought, is.
And finally, briefly, what do you find in your reporting is his best possible defense?
I think this, if the case were fringe benefits alone, that would be a highly unusual case. Those are extremely rare to bring. So until we see the full case, what we know now makes it difficult to anticipate what he might use to defend himself. But what we know now is not the full case. So again, it's hard to predict how exactly his lawyers will work on his behalf, given that we're only partially seeing what's really going on.
Yeah. Well, you have a big story there with your colleagues, Jonah Bromwich. Thank you for telling us a little bit more about it on the beat. We have our shortest break, 60 seconds. When we come back, Michael Cohen, who figures into that story and this investigation, speaks out for the first time. That's next. Joining me now for reaction to this big Trump CFO Weisselberg news is Michael Cohen himself, Donald Trump's former lawyer, host of the Mea Culpa podcast, author of the book Disloyal. Thanks for coming back, Michael.
How you doing, Ari?
I'm well, thank you. This article, which dropped like a bombshell in this hour last night, actually, from the New York Times, we just heard from the reporter, it ends, the final line of the article refers to Mr. Weisselberg being involved in a different federal investigation regarding Trump hush money. And then the article ends, Mr. Cohen, who pleaded guilty to federal charges in 2018, is now cooperating with Mr. Vance's investigation. Where the article ended, sir, is where we begin tonight. Why do you think they, at the Times, and the piece there, what are they getting at? Tell us your reaction to all of this.
Well, first of all, I've been cooperating since day number one. I cooperated with the Southern District of New York, despite they didn't believe that I didn't give them everything, which is just not true. I cooperated with the Attorney General's office, with the Southern with the New York DA's office. I cooperated with five different congressional offices. So I cooperated. Thank you, New York Times, for acknowledging that. But one of the things that I took away from this is Alan Weisselberg really knows that he's got the heat coming right now, especially when you have somebody who is as seasoned a lawyer as Mark Pomerantz. Alan Weisselberg, I want to be clear, though, is not the primary target in this investigation. And like what happened to me, he will unfortunately, or fortunately, depending upon which way you see it, he will become collateral damage. But it's not just Alan Weisselberg that's going to be collateral damage. It's going to be his two sons as well. Barry, who worked for the company dealing with Woolman Rink and Lasker Rink and the carousel. And Jack Weisselberg, who was involved with Ladder Capital with the two loans that were given to the Trump Organization. So Alan has a choice. The choice is, do you want to spend the golden years of your life behind bars while remaining loyal to Donald Trump, knowing that Trump would absolutely 100% not be loyal to him? Or are you going to allow yourself and your sons to go to prison versus pass along the information and try to get yourself some sort of leniency? The question, look, I believe that all the people who are watching your show right now, put into that situation, whether you and your children go to prison or you provide information, knowing that that documentary evidence is already in the hands of the district attorney and the attorney general, you're not going to escape it. So what's the smart move?
Yeah, or the self-preservation move, smart or not. The essential move for a lot of people is how they'd look at it. As for the last line of the article, Michael, well, they seem to be intimating that he dropped a dime on you and now it might be your turn.
Well, he definitely dropped a dime or more than a dime. He probably dropped a couple of dimes on me in order to, you know, in order to get
30, 40 cents easy. Yeah.
At least. Right. In order to get that limited immunity that he got, knowing that Alan Weisselberg was involved in the entire setup for the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. You know, the records exist, the conversations exist between myself, Trump. I mean, those were released by recording. On top of that, they have, again, documentary evidence. You see, the problem with everybody in the Trump organization is that they all lie, and they will continue, as I did, including with Congress. We all lied in order to protect Donald. The problem, though, is that there are documents that show opposite, that I wasn't the only one that lied in the creation of that document. It was Ivanka and Jared and the lawyers and Seculo and Cobb and you name it, Abby Lowell. all of them were involved in the establish in the setting up of that information to Congress. So yes, I'm the one that suffered the consequences, and my belief is that Allen is going to suffer the same consequences.
You're referring there to both the hush money payments, where you're saying, yes, he was involved, and we have reporting on that, and then separately referring to the federal charge regarding misleading Congress or false statement to Congress, and you're saying that laundry list of names you just mentioned were people who were in on that presentation, is what you're saying?
Yes, and again, the point I was trying to make is that everybody lies for Donald, and it's okay to lie so long as that there's no documentary evidence in order to back up the opposite. And my point to you and to your listeners and to your viewers is that that information is already in the hands of those people that are seeking the cooperation of Allen Weisselberg. But, you know, Ari, I always on your show, I always say something which is a little bit different than everybody else. I believe Allen has already cooperated and is actively cooperating with the district attorney's office. I truly believe it, because
what,
at the end of the day,
what evidence do you have for that?
Nothing, just a personal belief, considering Allen does not want the same thing that happened to me to happen to him and to his children. Again, Allen is basically dissecting it and looking at it from a realistic perspective.
When you look at this New York Times story, were you one of the witness sources for it?
Well, I really don't want to talk about, you know, what role I've played so far in terms of the district attorney's investigation or some of the things that they've asked me. And just to go back one step, when I said that I believe he's already cooperating, we also have to look at the facts that's already out there. They brought in Jeff McConney, the assistant controller, a man who works solely for Allen Weisselberg for over 30 some odd years. Jeff doesn't want to go to prison either. So do you think he didn't corroborate documentary evidence that they had on Allen Weisselberg? And now they're presenting it to Allen and saying to him, listen, you're not going to win this. Let me be very clear. You are not. Not only do we have you, we have issues with how you receive compensation, your son, your other son regarding loans made to the Trump Organization. You're really in a, as Allen Weisselberg, his favorite word, you have a conundrum.
He would say conundrum a lot. Well, this is a conundrum and then some. I think that you're referring to the witness problem that that Mr. Weisselberg would appear to have, which is everyone around him, his peers and subordinates, including the gentleman you mentioned, if they're cooperating or providing factual information, according to the evidence, that would be bad for Weisselberg. Then you go up above him and you have Donald Trump, who's not known to swoop in and do a thing to help people who have embattled legal problems, even on his behalf. I'm saying that obviously knowing the present company lived experience, which I think our viewers know about you, Michael. I asked that about the Time story, and I understand you're right to not say whether you're a source or not, but my job to ask the questions, because do you see anything in the story that struck you as off base or different from your experience, or did the story, which we just spoke to the reporter about, strike you as accurate? Because if the story is accurate in the main, it would suggest that the DA's office has moved past the point of no return in presenting the case on Weisselberg. And by that, I mean they're getting to that ham sandwich phase, that they either get the grand jury to go along or they don't, but they're past that point of no return. But I'm curious, again, because you're close to it, if you found it broadly accurate.
Yeah, I thought it was phenomenal reporting by the New York Times. There was nothing in there that I found to be inaccurate. It was a well-written, it was a well-sourced piece. And yes, I've said it on your show as well. I believe indictments start flying even, you know, within the next 30. I called it, I said before summer. And I do believe still that you're going to start seeing some of the low hanging fruit indictments. Because, look, at the end of the day, this is not just about Allen Weisselberg and his kids. And this is not just about ultimately getting, you know, to Donald Trump himself. There's Don Jr., there's Ivanka, there's Jared, there's Eric, there's, you know, there's Rudy. There's a whole group of people that are being looked at. This is not just, hey, let's figure out how to flip Allen Weisselberg, because Allen Weisselberg is the key. Allen Weisselberg is a key, but he is not the sole key. And that's why, again, I believe that he is going to provide whatever information that the DA's office wants, because if he doesn't and doesn't capture the immunity, somebody else will give it. It's just that simple.
Yeah. Michael Cohen, I think plenty of people were curious about your take and reaction given your centrality here. Thank you for coming on the beat, sir. Appreciate it.
Always good to see you, Ari.
Thank you. When we come back, we have our analysis and reporting on what makes someone flip and why it matters here. And the prosecutor who masterminded the art of flipping suspects, someone you may recognize from the Mueller probe, Andrew Weissman, coming up.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
Now, if you happen to be watching this program last night, you were probably there with us when the big story on Trump's money man, Weisselberg, crossed the wire. Now, we've gone through some of the reporting in context tonight, but what everyone really wants to know, what Michael Cohen was just speculating about, is will Weisselberg ever flip on Trump? Because the DA's case is built, clearly, on a plan to seek his cooperation and get it. But this is not some random witness. You don't get to be the Trump org CFO for this many years without demonstrating a certain type of loyalty. Trump prizes it, as well as secrecy, above traditional merit or skill for many hires. I'm putting that diplomatically. Weisselberg has been with the Trump family for the bulk of his career, playing the private backroom advisor, Trump's eyes and ears, according to confidential sources, while he is busy being Trump. And Weisselberg's no Omarosa. He's avoided most of Donald Trump's media appearances and big events and flashy sizzle, save for a single Apprentice appearance we found over 15 years ago.
Replacing George this week is my chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg. And you think George is tough? Wait till you see Alan.
Alan? I thought that Andy losing his lines of communication was a very serious matter. If this was a military maneuver and he lost his line of communication, he could lose an entire battalion.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a military maneuver. It was a reality show. But the point stands that Donald Trump didn't just rely on Weisselberg behind the scenes or just for writing checks. He actually made him the only non-family member to help Don Jr. and Eric run the entire company during Trump's one-term presidency. Before that, for key financial decisions, reporting shows there were usually only two people in the room, Trump and Weisselberg. That's why the DA wants so much from him. So those are two key things we know about him. That he knows it all, and that often, at key moments, it was just him and Trump alone. We also know that he has a kind of a idealization of Donald Trump, which probably, knowing Trump's narcissism, strengthens their bond.
Alan Weisselberg is defined by what Donald thinks about him.
Weisselberg is one of those total sycophants.
Alan would not take an hour or day off if Donald was in the office.
That doesn't breathe or inhale or exhale without Trump's permission or knowledge.
His office is right next door. He discusses everything with him.
So as we keep an eye on the smart call or self-preservation, there's also emotion here. Emotion can be the opposite of reason, and there's an emotional bond, something going on between Weisselberg and Trump. Now, we do know that Weisselberg has cooperated with authorities before, and he's done it in exchange for immunity in the hush money payments case when it was just him, Trump, and Cohen setting up the payments.
And I've spoken to Alan Weisselberg about how to set the whole thing up, so I'm all over that. And I spoke to Alan about it.
Yep. He spoke to Alan. That's true. But when the heat came, when someone was going to go down, Alan spoke to the feds. He, from what we know, threw Michael Cohen under the bus, which is why I just raised that with him and mentioned the end of the New Times article. However awkward it is when we have certain interview subjects on, this is the story. He got that immunity for testimony about Michael D. Cohen. Now, in a deal like that, you're supposed to tell prosecutors everything. But did Weisselberg find a way to focus on the things that implicated Cohen more than Trump? We don't have the raw interviews. We just have the fact that three men arranged a now convicted crime for the benefit of one of them, Donald Trump. And one of those men did the time. And one of them, Alan Weisselberg, wiggled away. So is this time any different? Well, in one key way. Last time, Weisselberg was throwing a peer under the bus. This time, his only move would appear to be up as the DA probes his own personal tax returns, bank records, gifts, the Mercedes. And unlike in the Cohen case, either Trump or Weisselberg now have legal exposure, maybe both. So it's not clear that there's anyone else that could take the call for the fall for them based on at least what we know right now. And Weisselberg's former daughter-in-law, who we've quoted here and interviewed because, well, she's one of the people the DA is talking to, she thinks ultimately he will fold.
There are a lot of differences when Donald says numbers are certain things and then Alan says numbers are certain things. They're not adding up.
I don't think Weisselberg would let his children go to jail. He must be shaking in his boots.
All right. You know, the reason I believe he'll flip, yes, is because since his behavior since 2017, what I've witnessed is that when he took over as trustee, he was not only nervous, but he started immediately hiding money in escrow confidentially.
As I've emphasized with you, because we try to be transparent in our reporting process here, these are not pundits you're hearing from. These are not random analysts, even well-skilled. These are not observers. These are people who were involved. Witnesses, family members, co-conspirators, if you want to put it that way, because Mr. Cohen did ultimately do time for the deal he did with Weisselberg. Many of these people think he will flip. Cohen speculated tonight, although clearly without evidence, as we ascertained, that he thinks maybe the flipping's already begun. This is the biggest thing that could hit Donald Trump legally ever. And for anyone who says, oh, well, we've heard this story before. How did it end? Well, you don't know how any story ends until it's over. Now, how does it work when prosecutors actually flip someone in a criminal probe? And what else does Merrick Garland need to do at the Justice Department to sweep out some of the Trump problems in the Biden era? We have a very special guest on several topics. Mueller prosecutor Andrew Weissman next. I'm joined now by Andrew Weissman, a veteran of the Mueller probe. He won the conviction against Paul Manafort and has extensive experience in flipping witnesses, also headed the fraud section at DOJ. Thanks for being here.
Nice to be here.
Let me read from what the prosecutors are looking at. Tax lawyers said it would be, quote, unusual to bring a case on a failure to pay taxes and fringe benefits alone against Weisselberg. The lawyers could think of no other recent example, a.k.a. precedent. I was discussing that with the Times journalist tonight. Your view of the outlines of the case described there?
Well, we don't know what they're investigating exactly. The biggest thing that we do know is this fringe benefit. But I would suspect if I were trying to make a case on Weisselberg to get him to flip, I would borrow a page from what we did when we were charging Rick Gates, that is Paul Manafort's number two. And what we did is we pointed out that there was individual liability that Rick Gates had with respect to his own tax returns, but he also aided and abetted and conspired in Paul Manafort's crimes. So he, in many ways, he was facing not just what Paul Manafort was facing, but he also faced his own individual liability. And then we did our homework and we were very open with his counsel about the evidence. And I think that is going to be the same tack that's going to be taken here, which is this is what you're facing and lay out all your proof to his defense counsel. And then also make sure they know that you mean business. In other words, that you're not afraid of actually pulling the trigger and bringing those charges.
And walk us through what you mean about the other potential liability. You're speaking about things that Weisselberg may have done for the corporate benefit of Trump Organization, not, he would argue, for his personal benefit, but you're saying he could still be in a lot of trouble for that?
Exactly. So if the Trump Organization was cheating on its own taxes, if Donald Trump was cheating on his personal taxes, it's hard to imagine that Alan Weisselberg wouldn't have participated in some way. So you want to basically make sure that you're looking at all of that proof. As Michael Cohen said, and I, as you know, I rarely agree with him, but I think he's right here, having the controller as somebody who appears to be cooperating is really significant. If I were the CFO, Weisselberg, and I knew the controller was cooperating and that the Manhattan District Attorney's Office has all of the documentation, assuming there is some crime there, they're going to have it because they now have a witness and they have the documentation.
You say you rarely agree with Cohen. I mean, I'd go further, Andrew. You were part of the Mueller team that farmed his case off to New York that sent him to prison.
Yeah, well, we partially farmed off the case. If you remember, we actually kept the part that was connected to the Mueller investigation, and the part that was unrelated was sent to the Southern District, and he was prosecuted for both. So that was an example of somebody who, you know, there was a strong case being made in two separate offices. That's a way to get somebody to flip, and it worked, at least in part, with respect to Michael Cohen.
All very interesting. It reminds everyone that you served at the DOJ, I mentioned, in more than one role, and of course the special counsel's office is part of a Justice Department, but you were positioned quite independently and quite adversarially, I would say, to much of what was going on in the Trump administration. Indeed, having read the Mueller report more than once, it is a voluminous detail about efforts to really undercut the way the DOJ is supposed to work. Whether that's impeachable or not, of course, is a congressional judgment. I bring that up because I want your reaction to other late-breaking news today, that this whole thing of the Trump DOJ going after someone that Donald Trump didn't like, whether he worked for them or not, you know, common storyline. This was a criminal probe and a civil lawsuit together that was against John Bolton. Do you see that as part of Merrick Garland continuing to have to clean house and really look under the hood of each thing that was done previously and decide whether it's has merit or not?
Yeah, I think that Merrick Garland and Lisa Monaco have their work cut out for them. But here's one where we really knew the story in advance, because if you recall, something that got very little attention was something that I thought was quite explosive, which was Ken Weinstein, a very respected lawyer in D.C., represented the woman in the White House who was in charge of the classification review. And she submitted an affidavit to the court many months ago, laying out what was, frankly, quite salacious, where she said, we did all of our work, we were quite rigorous, and I cleared the Bolton book for publication. And then the White House political people got involved and essentially pulled that all back. It's really hard to see how this Justice Department, reading that objectively, would think that it's appropriate to go forward with a criminal or civil case, because it really reeks of political interference in the classification process, or in this case, declassification process. And that's an area where there should be no politics, obviously, at all.
Yeah, appreciate your clarity there, Andrew. And it's important, and it goes to a long list where you have some people that it was an actual criminal probe. You have some where there were other measures taken. Then you have the seizing of records that we've been covering. But all of it together is enemies of the president. And a lot of it coming out of DOJ. So a lot of work to be done. Andrew Weissman, indebted for your expertise as always. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Coming up, there is history being made tonight. It has to do with the reckoning on race. And this one might even transcend politics. And turning tonight to live pictures here on the House floor, where lawmakers are voting on whether to make Juneteenth finally a federal holiday. Now, this bill is expected to pass. It's a rare bipartisan bill that's actually moved quickly through this Congress. There was a unanimous vote in the Senate yesterday. The holiday celebrated on June 19th. It commemorates the day in 1865 when a Union general told enslaved African Americans in Galveston, Texas, that they were free. The Civil War was over. Texas Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee spoke about the bill on the House floor today, standing next to images showing the tragedy of American slavery.
Juneteenth is as significant to African Americans as it will be to Americans, because we too are Americans. And it means freedom.
And the votes here show that there is bipartisanship, at least on the symbolism of the holiday. But it's against the backdrop of something we've been covering. Many Republican lawmakers at the state and federal level trying to limit a whole range of things, from voting to how much teachers can tell students about racial injustice or the legacy, factually, of slavery in America. It's an update we wanted to give you. And before we go tonight, I will remind you, as always, you can find me online at Ari Melber on social media or at arimelber.com, the best way to link with me. In fact, coming up, we'll have an update on a future show about much of your response to what we heard from Ben and Jerry when I had them on to discuss police reform. So you can always connect with me online. Thanks for watching The Beat.